Dealing with global poverty isn't something new. It's not a new headline. It's not a new idea. We've been talking about these issues since colonial times. But what's new is, maybe how some people are starting to think about these issues. We're going to talk about what the solution is, ultimately, for the global poverty problem. And there is one. There can be no question about that. So will broadband internet, antibiotics, or fertilizer cure global poverty? Probably not. Those are technical solutions that only treat symptoms. And that is what my guest this hour is saying in a new book titled The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor. My guest is the author of that book, William Easterly, professor of economics at New York University and a director of NYU's Development Research Institute. Professor, welcome to the Joy Cardine program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's talk about the problem of global poverty in the aggregate. How bad is this problem?
Well, it's a lot worse than we would like it to be, but the good news is it's getting better over time. The rate of global poverty has fallen dramatically over the past few decades, and the steady trend is downward.
And what explains this improvement?
Well, I think one of the major factors is the spread of the values of individual rights and democracy and economic and political freedom around the world that has facilitated the spread of technology and fostered international trade, in which people in poor countries can import literally the technical solutions through international trade just by buying new products like antibiotics that were not previously available, that have led to a dramatic fall in child mortality rates as well as falling poverty levels.
And that kind of flies in the face of the conventional wisdom of the fight against poverty, say, over the last 100 years, really. Contrast what the experts have been saying with the thesis of your book.
Yeah, the experts have kind of this very top-down approach to poverty that you identify lots and lots of technical problems of the poor and identify technical solutions like, you know, child mortality, and the technical solutions, antibiotics. And then you hand that list over to someone. It's usually left unspecified who that someone is, but in practice it turns out to be the ruling party in whatever country you're working in, and that ruling party is typically autocratic. You have a dictator at the top, and so the implicit model, nobody advertises this up front, but the implicit model is sort of wise experts from the West advising dictators in the rest. And that's been the model, which flies in the face of the evidence that really dictators are the problem, not the solution, that the solution is individual rights, more democracy, more freedom, more accountability.
Illustrations in the very beginning of your book, you talk about an incident that happened in Uganda, and you frame it, what if this happened in the United States? How would we feel about that? Talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, there was this tragic event in Uganda that's happened almost exactly 4 years ago, where a World Bank project resulted in soldiers arriving in a village in Uganda, in Mubende District, Uganda, evicting the farmers at gunpoint, torching their homes, torching livestock, killing cattle, even holding them off at gunpoint from rescuing their burning homes. And one of their children died in this fire. And the farmers were told, this land is no longer yours. It was handed over to a forestry company. The sales enriched the Ugandan government coffers. The World Bank sponsored the whole thing. So here's an example where you have what could have been called a technical solution, that somebody thought forestry was better than food crops for this piece of land, but the technical solution resulted in this gross violation of human rights. What's even more shocking is even after this story was on the front page of the New York Times, the World Bank never kept its own promise to investigate its role in this tragedy. And even more shocking than that is that nobody has really protested that. The mentality in development doesn't seem to care enough about rights of poor people to protest that kind of thing. And again, it's so different from what would have happened, as you said, and if it had happened in Ohio, we would have been outrage. There would have been huge crises. People would have lost their jobs, but this doesn't.
Well, people would have gone to jail.
Or gone to jail for this. But in Uganda, everyone is operating with impunity because we have so little respect for the rights of poor people.
And where does that, what does that come from? I mean, you've got the World Bank and other organizations that, you know, we read all the time are working to put money into these areas where poverty is so endemic. But where does this attitude come from that doesn't allow for the respect of individual property rights?
Well, I think it's... I think there is a double standard that we care a lot more about our own rights than the rights of people in the rest of the world. And there's still this sort of condescending attitude that maybe people in the rest of the world, maybe they're not really ready for exercising their own rights. Maybe they don't have enough initiative or rationality to use their own individual rights wisely. And this sort of condescending paternalistic attitude is sort of what enshrines the effective regime in development, which is sort of the wise experts from the World Bank and, you know, middle-aged white economics professors like myself saying what is best for Africa instead of, you know, letting Africans find their own solutions through their own initiative, which they are actually already doing in amazing ways.
How did you end up your position on this sort of shifted over time? What was there some seminal event or something that was a kind of an aha moment for you when you realized we needed to take a different approach?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing I want to say about that is I do believe that everyone involved in this is really well intentioned and trying to do the right thing, and I have just kind of arrived at the wrong mindset, and I know that because I was myself well-intentioned and in the wrong mindset for so long during my own career at the World Bank when I was part of this sort of expert complex, arrogant expert complex. I guess the aha moments came kind of in pieces for me. One was just noticing when rights violations did happen that they got so little attention compared to, you know, the kind of things that, the kind of criticisms that seem to be allowed and that seem to get a lot of attention are to say, like, oh, you know, Angelina Jolie is so ridiculous supporting Jeff Sachs's Millennium Village project in Africa, and Angelina doesn't know what she's doing. You know, but a story like that gets huge amounts of attention. A story like the one we've just been talking about, Mubende District, Uganda, I ran that on my blog a few years ago, and that got so little attention. And I guess it was that imbalance that just outraged me, that why do we care so little about the rights of poor people? And so I started, you know, digging and doing more research on this and just realizing, hey, it's not only that we're morally wrong not to respect their rights, but rights are really the engine of development. There's lots of economics research that supports that.
You mentioned the World Bank. What is their approach to poverty? We've talked a little bit about, you know, wise experts from the West, that sort of thing. But what is their approach to poverty, and why don't they foster liberty in poor areas?
You know, they actually have something in their charter that says they're not allowed to even consider whether a country is democratic or not when they give loans. Which is pretty remarkable when you think about it. If you think democracy is, first of all, a value that we cherish a lot in the West, and we're the main financiers of the World Bank, that we would not be promoting these same values abroad through the World Bank. The World Bank is lending to autocrats because it's not even allowed in its own charter to differentiate. That's really a mindset of a technocratic mindset, a technical mindset that it's all about just pure technology and technical solutions, and that is blind to the rights violations, which will mean that the technical solutions will either not be implemented at all by an autocrat who doesn't care, or will be implemented even in a harmful way, as happened in Uganda.
There are other organizations and experts out there that you talk about in your book. Are you including things like the Red Cross, for example, or UNICEF?
Well, there's some, you know, variation across different large organizations how much they're bought into this kind of technocratic expert military complex in development. You know, I guess the one foundation that I studied a lot of the rhetoric and work of a lot was the Gates Foundation, and I was very, very kind of disappointed there that first Gates is a big cheerleader for, I mean, Gates, again, is very, he's a great man, he's very compassionate, done a lot of good for advocacy for the world's poor, very generous with his own money, of course, but he seems to have embraced the expert complex approach to development, and maybe it's because of his own background in technology that he finds this so appealing. But he also campaigns for more official aid to really autocratic regimes like Ethiopia and Uganda.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our conversation on the Ideas Network. 800-642-1234. Talking with Bill Easterly, professor of economics at New York University and a director of NYU's Developmental Research Institute, about his most recent book, The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor. You'd like to join the program, 800-642-1234. You can also join us via email. The address is talk@WPR.org, or you can reach out on Facebook. Look for The Joy Cardine Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. Again, 800-642-1234. Do you agree with our guest? Should we address poverty around how should we address poverty around the globe? And can technology solve this problem alone, or is democracy what we need? And how do we address the root causes of poverty, not only around the world, but perhaps here in the United States? And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what's wrong with how we handle poverty today, and then eventually get into how we might do a better job of it. My guest again, Bill Easterly, professor of economics at New York University. You can join us at 800-642-1234. We'll have some of your calls in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking the wrong approach when it comes to battling poverty around the world. We need to pay more attention to democratic human rights and perhaps less to purely technical solutions like broadband and antibiotics or better fertilizer. The book under discussion this hour is The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor. We have its author with us, Bill Easterly, professor of economics at New York University and director of NYU's Development Research Institute. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And we do have callers on the line. Let's take a call first from John in Madison. John, thanks for joining us. Hello, John.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. What you're saying is something that I kind of experienced for 2 years in Cameroon in West Africa. I worked for a World Bank project there. I got my 2 degrees from the United States. I worked for a genetics company in the U.S. prior to going to work for the World Bank, a breeding program, a livestock breeding program. But when I got there, this idea of the experts that you're talking about, even though I could do everything, because I was an indigenous of Cameroon, you had people that were being sent, white middle-aged men sent from Germany and everywhere, to come and do what I am an expert and able to do. But they were sending these people to come there and do the same thing. Even when I was crying to the administration of Cameroon that I know how to do things at no cost to the administration. But these people will fly in 2 weeks at a time, stay in very expensive hotels, being chauffeured around, and they ended up for 2 weeks each time each group of those experts came in. They never did anything. They were only from hotels back to the breeding farms, yet I was there doing everything. But they were the ones making the money. I worked there for 2 years as an indigenous of Cameroon. I never got paid, so I quit. I just left the project. And those are the kinds of things that happen when they go there. They don't want to use the indigenous who know how to do the project. And they just come there with all this expertise and say, hey, they know how to do this, whereas they are not able to do that. They were shipping semen from Germany, frozen or semen that does not work, whereas we could get fresh semen I will talk until I was kind of getting crazy. No one will listen to me, you know, but the experts that came from Europe, from the World Bank.
So, John, if you could just ask you a follow-up to that, what you would say then is that these projects and so forth demonstrate a real sort of being out of touch with what's really going on the ground.
They're really out of touch, and they are not in any way helping the people. Because take, for instance, with regards to the frozen semen that was coming in. I'm an expert. I'm teaching at a university here in Wisconsin. I know that frozen semen is not good. But I'm telling the people, the experts that come from Germany, say it's good, simply because the semen was being bought from a German company. So the people from Germany were trying to market their semen into Cameroon. And I'm telling you, not one of that straw of semen ever got used in Cameroon. Because by the time it got to the farm, it was completely destroyed.
Hmm. John, thanks for the call. Professor?
Well, John raises a really good point. It's not only a question of experts, but which experts. And, you know, do the experts have local knowledge? And, of course, local people are the most likely to have local knowledge. You know, what happens with democratic rights is people who have the power to force their government to do the solutions that work by through democratic accountability, they will force the government to use the right local knowledge that's available to bear upon the problem. What happens in the aid system, if we have two totally unaccountable regimes working together, we have the autocratic regime of Cameroon working in partnership with the completely unaccountable regime of the World Bank and other foreign aid agencies, where, you know, if the expert solutions don't work, nobody is held accountable. Nobody pays any penalty. The World Bank experts, as I was one myself, I can testify, go on, you know, staying in the good hotels and earning high salary with no adverse consequences for recommending something that turned out not to work.
So the World Bank it's an entity. Who set it up? It's not accountable to anyone. Who operates it? Who owns it?
It's owned by all the governments of the world. But the majority of the shares are held by Western nations, by North America and Western European nations. So it's really part of this sort of Western foreign policy apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, part of the reason it's so unaccountable is the Western powers want it that way. They can use it as an instrument in their own foreign policy interests. So, for example, we've already mentioned Ethiopia, Uganda, as two autocratic regimes that receive a lot of World Bank aid. They're also allies in the U.S. war on terror, and that's one of the political reasons why the World Bank can operate with impunity, because the U.S. wants it to give money to these governments because they're allies.
Well, and money certainly was a prominent feature in John's comments earlier about his experience in Cameroon. If you followed the money, the frozen semen was being promoted by the company that was selling it from Germany.
Yeah. Well, of course, also, you know, acting in the interest of Western companies, these are, you know, ironically, democracy in the West has this blind spot that it acts in the interest of the citizens and the businesses and the security interests of the West, but it has no democratic incentive to act in the interests of the poor people in the receiving country because they don't vote in U.S. elections. So that's the blind spot of our own democracy, is in our foreign policy and our aid policy.
Could you talk for a little bit about some contemporary examples of failures in democracy holding back prosperity?
It's like almost all of them. Africa is the region that has the sort of longest unhappy history with a strong man, one-party rule, one big man dictatorships. And that really was a legacy of the colonial era, which is also, of course, a very autocratic, unaccountable regime. The British and French colonial authorities had absolute power over colonial subjects. So there's this, you know, one of the research findings of economists is that autocracy is worse the longer the history of autocracy has been. And that's so, you know, much of Africa is being held back by a very long history of autocracy. The same in the Arab world with a very long history of autocracy. And that's also explaining a little bit of why the Arab Spring turned out to be disappointing, is that it's very hard to overcome a long history of autocracy. And the disappointments of the Arab Spring should not be blamed on the new democratic regimes, but on the long history of autocracy that preceded them, that had messed up the country so much that it could not be fixed quickly, and in some cases it's already lapsed back into autocracy.
Is there anything wrong inherently with efforts to offer technical solutions like broadband internet to poor nations? I mean, does one come at the cost of the other? Can that same money that we might use for broadband be used to further democracy? Is this an either or should it be a both and?
Well, I think, you know, the most important things to avoid are, first of all, directly financing an autocratic regime, giving, you know, official aid money directly to an autocratic regime, as we are doing in Uganda, Ethiopia, the examples that I've mentioned, Cameroon, that John just mentioned. The second is kind of, let's get the ideas straight. So, you know, Bill Gates, you know, again, a very well-intentioned man, but he praised the government of Ethiopia for and gave it credit for the rapid reduction in poverty and child mortality over a period of only 5 years. Well, you know, you have to ask the big question about autocracy. If it's so easy for these technical solutions to eliminate the problems of poverty, why didn't the autocrats do them already? The reason they didn't do them already is because they have no incentive to. They stay in power through coercion and repression. Only democratic governments are forced to do things for the benefit of the population by the citizens demanding these good things from exercising their individual rights.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our discussion of global poverty and its causes and solutions this hour on the Ideas Network. The Facebook page is the Joy Cardine Show. You can leave a comment or question there. You can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Do you agree with our guest? How should we be addressing poverty around the globe? Can technology solve it? Is democracy all we need? How do we address the root causes of poverty around the world and here in the United States? Well, those are all good questions for us to consider here. As we talk with Bill Easterly, professor of economics at New York University, director of NYU's Development Research Institute. He's the author of the book, The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor. You spend some time in your book kind of tracing the history of our attitude toward poverty, and you go back to the immediate post-war period, and by that I mean post-World War I, and the formation of the League of Nations. Why was that significant in the fight against poverty around the world?
Well, I think the origins of the technical approach to development give us some insight into why the rights of the poor play so little role. Because the formative years of this technical idea were right after World War I. Woodrow Wilson announced this new system of League of Nations mandates, which would be countries under the kind of paternalistic control of some of, you know, more advanced League of Nations members, which in every other sense were simply colonies. But Woodrow Wilson justified these sort of new form of colonialism as using very much the technical approach to development, that the mandates would be run by, say, Britain, who could bring to bear the advanced technical knowledge that it had to solve the problems of poverty. So the key to understand is that these ideas took shape at a time when no one could even conceive that, say, Africans were equal to Europeans. You know, racism was open and openly stated during this period. And the paternalistic idea towards what were thought to be inferior people was very openly stated. That's the environment in which these technical ideas took shape. And you know, so that's That's, I think, helpful in understanding and kind of a reality check on understanding our own paternalism today. I'm not saying that we're racist today in the same extreme way that we were 100 years ago. That's no longer true. And yet the erosion of racism has not been enough to overthrow the technical ideas that were originally justified by racism.
Well, I mean, there's still at least, if not overt, there's certainly some covert racism. We have, in this country, we've got what are called the dog whistle politics of race. We have a member of the United States Congress basically saying that people in the inner city don't have jobs, more or less, because they're not willing to work. You know, there's still this attitude that the poor are poor because, that's just the way it is. And if they would work harder, they wouldn't be poor.
Sure. And, I agree with you. Certainly racism has not gone away. And it's been replaced by even open statements, or sort of softer statements of paternalism and condescension and unequal standards. So if we go back to the Uganda story that we were talking about earlier and how unthinkable this would have been if it had happened in Ohio. You know, why is there this double standard? Why do we care so little about the rights of Ugandans compared to the rights of Ohioans? I think it's, you know, because of a condescending, unequal standard that persists, that maybe is not overt racism, but is certainly paternalism and condescension, not really believing that poor people deserve rights or care about rights or can use their own rights, when in fact they can, they will, they do, they are already, they're doing, of course they deserve equal rights, of course all men are created equal. You know, I wish we could stick to our own values on this.
Well, why don't we? I mean, we talk a pretty good game about supporting democracy around the world and, you know, even going so far as to engage in regime change when it suits us. Why have we not been able to be true to our own stated values?
Well, you know, we saw this already a lot during the Cold War when we were very willing to embrace brutal dictators as allies for political expediency, as allies against, for fighting the Cold War against the Russians. And people think of that as kind of the bad old days that no longer exist. Well, I'm sorry, they still do exist. Today it's the war on terror. Today we still exist. We still endorse brutal autocrats. And, you know, the technical approach gives a kind of benevolent cover to all of this. So, you know, there are some bad things happening in the war on terror that give us a not very good image, you know, torture, Guantanamo Bay, killings of civilians, and aerial bombing and drones in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And having these sort of technical ideas give another more benevolent side of American policy is very politically convenient, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And the only part we don't want to talk about is really overt recognizing of the rights of poor people, because then we would be led back to these embarrassing questions of how we ourselves might be violating their rights at Guantanamo Bay and drone killings and so on. So
our views on democracy around the world are pretty decidedly pragmatic. We're in favor of democracy,
yeah,
as long as it supports us.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And again, this is something that also has deep historical roots, you know, just as technical development was used to give a kind of benevolent image to colonial regimes. Today it's used to give a benevolent image to U.S. foreign policy.
And people wonder why I'm so cynical. Let's take a call from Jeannie in Richford. Jeannie, good day to you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And I'd like to have the professor comment on industrial agriculture here in Wisconsin and also over in other countries. I've been studying it. It seems like every time a large animal factory comes in, these dairy farms, they come in and you put 200 farms out of business. They can't keep up with the market. And you see it here, the farmers going out of business, family farms shutting down. And then you read in other countries, in India, the suicide rate is so high because they've all been displaced and they can't, they go bankrupt and they commit suicide. And then you read here in the United States, back in the 80s, we were having so many farmers kill themselves. And I was wondering if you could comment on that, how it affects the poor, because it seems like they're always the ones displaced off their land.
Yeah, the... Well, first of all, experts need to be humble on what they know. I have to confess I don't have the local knowledge in Wisconsin to give you a good answer. I would say, as applied to India or other parts of the poor countries, I think the problem is most blatant and brutal when foreign companies will bribe the government to steal the lands of the local peasants, the local farmers. And that was kind of at the heart of the Uganda story that we were talking about earlier. It's happening all over the developing world, that poor people are not, it's not just that they're being driven out by the market. The market is not really the villain. The villain is that the government and the security forces of the private companies are just driving the peasants off their own land. They even own, it's their own land, but the land is taken away from them by this land grabbing that's going on in the name of industrial agriculture. And that's the most brutal form of what you're talking about, and such a clear example of what we're talking about today, of how any approach to development that doesn't respect the rights of the poor is going to wind up doing them harm instead of good.
Jeannie, thanks so much for that call. We have other callers on the line and room for you if you care to join us at 800-642-1234, or send an email or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. All those avenues open to you for our discussion with Bill Easterly, professor of economics at New York University, director of NYU's Development Research Institute. He's the author of The Tyranny of Experts, Economists, Dictators, and the Forgotten Rights of the Poor. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Global poverty is the topic under discussion this hour on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. My guest is Bill Easterly, professor of economics at New York University, author of The Tyranny of Experts. We have some callers on the line. You could be one of them at 800-642-1234. Let's go next to Sharon in Berlin. Sharon, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Just was thinking as you were talking there that it seems like when we talk about anything global, it means outside of the United States, which I'm sure is not true. We have very much poverty in our state, and we have school kids feeding other school kids and having their own food pantries and things like this because our children don't have food at home. But what my point was this. I spent 2 years on the Navajo Reservation. If we want to know what happens when our experts come in and take over and place white North American or European values on developing countries, we can't change them. We need to go meet them where they are. Look at there's one successful tribe in this nation. And
Sharon, we're losing your cell connection, but I think we have the gist of what you wanted to talk about. Bill Easterly?
Yeah, Sharon, that's a great example of, happening within the borders of the U.S., what's essentially almost an analog. Perfect analogy to kind of first world versus third world, where we have our own internal third world, and we're having the same failures inside that we're having in our foreign policy and our aid policies. And again, it's this profound disrespect for the people that we are supposedly trying to help.
So how exactly we've been tossing around the idea that, broadband internet is one of the solutions that the technology sector has advanced for fighting poverty. Certainly technology has a role in helping people do better economically, and high speed internet has been demonstrated to be a great economic tool. Just because of the access it gives people to so many different kinds of resources, but how can this be coupled with the kinds of democratic reforms that you're talking about to spur economic growth?
Well, I'm a big believer in technology as part of the answer to poverty. That's not the issue that I'm questioning here. Of course, technology will be part of the answer, but technology works best when local people trying to improve their own lives are the ones who decide what technologies they want, and they have the economic rights and the political rights to make that happen. if it's all done by experts from the top down. So let me give you a broadband example. There actually is a UN broadband commission that's chaired by the dictator of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. And, you know, their top-down solution is just, you know, by brute force, just kind of wire everywhere in the world, whether they want it or not. There's a great researcher who has studied this and found that when broadband sort of comes in this top-down way, the main use of it turns out to be sort of young men are just playing video games and watching porn on the broadband. Not exactly what we had in mind for solving poverty. What seems at first like an obvious technical fix, that how could it go wrong? Well, there are lots of ways technology can go wrong, and it's only when local people with local knowledge are the ones doing the solutions that we get it right.
Mary in Brookfield wanted to say that she heard that the World Bank was charging huge interest rates to poor nations for loans. How big a concern do you think this is?
The World Bank has had sort of this recurrent pattern of lending to countries so much that then the poor countries have debt crises and get too much debt, and the debt payment starts strangling out everything else in the poor countries' budgets. And that's been a repeated pattern throughout World Bank history. That's the last round of kind of extreme debt problems, and then the World Bank was forced to give some debt forgiveness, happened around the year 2000. And we're now in kind of the build-up to another debt crisis. It's just the same pattern repeating itself.
Let's take another phone call. This time we'll go to Sally in Boyceville. Sally, thanks for joining us.
Hi. There's one area I think that needs also a lot of work on, and that is the education of women and their role in helping to bring the poverty level down. I know that in areas where we have gone in and educated the women and helped with them to form their own businesses of making products that they can sell globally, has very much helped with that cause.
Professor?
Yeah, so this is a very important point. So when we talk about individual rights for the poor, we're talking about equal rights for everyone. So equal rights for men and women, for example. What happens under dictatorship and autocracy is not only the kind of blanket denial of rights to everyone, but also the dictators will use unequal rights in a way to stay in power. So they will use, you know, men's oppression. So the dictator will oppress the men. The men will oppress the women. The dictators, ethnic group in power, will oppress other ethnic groups and deny them equal rights. So a big problem of the denial of rights to the poor is also unequal rights for different groups of the poor and playing them off against each other, even mobilizing, you know, cultural conservatism or hatred as a device for the dictator to stay in power, hatred towards women or hatred towards ethnic minority groups.
One of the things that you talk about in your book is how is the diffusion of technology, and how one country will maybe import the technology of another country and then make improvements on it. Talk about how this takes place in the developing world today.
Yeah, so it's a good time in this conversation for some happier news. And the happy news is that both economic and political freedom is spreading around the world, and we're dealing with much less repressive regimes that repress economic and political rights than what used to be in power. And one of the beneficial side effects of that is the spread of technology. It's because when you allow individuals more freedom to buy and sell from whomever they want to, you know, they can buy technology solutions from foreigners who have been at the technological frontier and invented something, so they can even make a jump from, say, you know, a typewriter to an iPad, which enables a much bigger economic payoff than what we get from going from iPad 4 to an iPad Air. And that can have huge benefits for a poor country. So the benefits that are available when you start granting more freedom to the poor, both their economic and political rights, are really amazing, and it's already happening all around the world and bringing lots of beneficial solutions, lots of solved problems of the poor as opposed to the unsolved problems we've been talking about earlier.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Kenneth in Janesville next. Kenneth, thanks for joining us.
Yes. As I understand it, millions and millions of more people have come out of poverty within the last 20 years. And I'm sorry I'm late in asking the question, but why is the professor concerned about this when more people, I mean, we don't hear about it a lot, but more people have come out of poverty than the population of the United States in the last 20 years. And I'm talking about China and India.
All right. Thanks, Kenneth. Professor?
Well, Kenneth, that's a great question. That's, what I'm trying to say in the answer to the previous question, that I think there is a lot of good news to celebrate, which is that even though the development experts and the aid agencies and the Gates Foundation may not recognize a role for rights of the poor themselves recognize a big right for a big central role for the rights of the poor. They're asserting their own rights. And that's a big part of the story in some of these rapid economic growth like China. China is usually thought of as like evidence for the autocracy side, but I think it's the opposite. What actually happened in China is peasants started demanding, they were starving on the collective farms. They started demanding the right to farm their own individual family plots. And after the death of Mao, there was no longer such a repressive force to put down this resistance. They successfully switched over on their own to family plots and produced a lot more food and ended poverty for themselves. And then the government belatedly sort of went along and recognized this from the top down, but it really was a success from the bottom up of poor people asserting their own rights. This is happening all around the world, and that has a lot to do with this historic reduction in poverty that we're seeing. So, you know, poor people are solving their own problems despite the inability of us experts to get the right ideas.
Is the current economic system around the world, which could be at least loosely described as free market capitalism, is that part of the problem here? Would an alternative economic system do a better job of lifting people out of poverty?
Well, I think the proven, tried and true kind of vehicle for ending poverty is what we have really experienced ourselves in our own history in the U.S. and other countries have experienced, Japan, more recently Taiwan and South Korea, and, of course, Western Europe and Australia, New Zealand, Canada. And it's some combination of, markets and state. And the argument is not really, the fine-tuning that a lot of our partisan passion is about in the U.S. of should the state have a bigger or a smaller role. It's really about making both markets and the state work better by both of them being accountable to the consumers and citizens. So, when markets don't work well, only when monopolies, often supported by state power, can exist to kind of disregard the choices of consumers. As long as we have the right to drive the bad companies out of business, then we hold our companies accountable to us. And that does require some amount of state regulation that we democratically choose.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, making our states work better so that the state regulatory policies are really for the benefit of the consumers and are not just a device to give more power to the existing powerful corporations, which is how they can be misused if our governments are not democratically accountable. So it's a combination of democracy, political rights, and economic rights that are mutually reinforcing, that work together.
We get a lot of messages on the internet, on television, on the radio, in our snail mail boxes, if you will, and in emails asking us to donate to this or that organization that's fighting poverty somewhere in the world. How do you recommend that ordinary people who want to donate to something or who would like to help, how do you recommend that they spend their money in this regard?
Well, I guess I would, that's a big question because that would require, you know, evaluating each and every non-governmental organization. But I think what the general guidance I could suggest is that I think there's been way too much emphasis on organizations that primarily focus on this sort of expert technical approach to development, and way too little emphasis on organizations that are just campaigning for poor people's rights, for human rights, for individual rights. So an organization like Human Rights Watch, for example, is really doing great things around the world for the rights of poor people. So that's the kind of organization I think deserves more funding, and some of the others I'm not going to name deserve a little bit less.
Okay. Well, what about the United States? Certainly we have our own poverty issues here. Is there some lesson that you see from what's working elsewhere in the world that could help us here in the United States?
Well, you know, the United States, we have to remember there's no democratic utopia anywhere in the world, and we're certainly not a democratic utopia here in the U.S., and some of the same problems can recur inside that I'm talking about on the outside. If there are government programs that are intended to benefit the poor, and then at the same time there are efforts to keep the poor from voting through restrictive voter registration laws or other ways in which poor people's rights are abused by the police through racial profiling. These are all rights issues that exist within our own society, and we are still very much a work in progress. As you mentioned, so much racism that still exists earlier. You know, we are also still democratizing. We are also still, you know, realizing the ideal that all men are created equal, and we're not there yet. And it's going to, you know, this campaign should not only be about the equal rights for the poor, but equal rights within the U.S.
How optimistic are you that we can begin addressing the root causes of poverty as you lay them out in your book?
Well, what is hopeful is that the long-run trends, the long-run global trends, are really positive. So there, if you look at specific measures of how much democracy there is around the world, for example, there's an organization called Freedom House that classifies countries as free, not free, or partly free. And the number of not free countries has fallen, and the number of free countries has increased quite a lot over the period that Freedom House has been tracking this since 1972. The long-run trend towards free countries is really upward. And, of course, this is, one of the huge dramatic events that we should not forget so quickly is the fall of the Berlin Wall that allowed now countries like Poland and the Czech Republic and Slovenia to be very prosperous, democratic places. But it's also reflecting that there are not as many really bad autocrats in Latin America, which used to be dominated by military rulers, or in Africa or in Asia as there used to be, and there are more Democrats.
And, that sounds like a great trend that we would want to see continued. But what do we have to do with it? I mean, is it because of policies, or is this an inevitable trend that was going to happen anyway?
Certainly not. This is certainly not something U.S. foreign policy gets the credit for. It's really poor people on their own asserting their own democratic rights. I mean, for example, the democratic revolution in South Korea, which has now been a democracy for more than 25 years, was started by a student democratic activist movement. And when one of those students, a student named Park Chung-jul, died at the hands of police torture in January 1987. There was this huge outburst of popular outrage in South Korea that forced South Korea autocrats to give in to democratic movements.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Professor, because we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Sure.
William Easterly, Professor of Economics at New York University, author of The Tyranny of Experts. This program was produced by Christy Taylor, on-air production by Bill Martins. Thanks to both of them. I'm John Munson. In for Joy Cardine, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.